There is a famous statement. It is called Lord Acton's Dictum. It is familiar to most of us, but we do not often know its context. Lord Acton, speaking about the infallibility of the Pope, the dogma that was going around the Roman Catholic Church, said this: "I cannot accept your canon that we are to judge Pope and King unlike other men, with a favorable presumption that they do no wrong. If there is any presumption, it is the other way, against the holders of power, increasing as the power increases. Historic responsibility has to make up for the want of legal responsibility. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority, still more when you superadd the tendency of or certainty of corruption by full authority. There is no worse heresy than the fact that the office sanctifies the holder of it." This we have summarized by that glib expression, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And yet, it is not necessarily that we should conclude that power corrupts, or that absolute power corrupts absolutely, for the ultimate absolute power is indeed God, who is good. Indeed, it is not power that corrupts, but sin. Power merely gives you an avenue to express your sin to a greater number of people. And yet, we see that sin can be an occasion to sin. The other way around. For in our section today, Saul, seeking to cling to his power, sins in a quite unambiguous and horrific way. As a lawyer, I kind of like this because you have this judicial setting going on. And I want to look at it in the three judicial terms. You have the court, you have the trial, and you have the verdict. The court is set in the first couple of verses. It's a rather ominous scene, with Saul bringing his entourage together and holding court. He begins whining about his misfortunes, and the comfort from Saul comes from a rather unlikely source. He holds court in Gibeah, his hometown. Verse 6, "When Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all of his servants were standing about him." Saul found out that David was back in Judah. You remember, David had left and gone to Gath, the city of the Philistines, but he had made himself rather an interesting form of character there and had been excluded. He then went back into Judah. He gathered together some men who were distressed and his family. He took his mother and father over to Moab, this land where his great-great-grandmother was from, Ruth. And there he left his mother and father with the king of Moab and returned to the forests of Israel, of Judah. Now Saul hears that David is playing Robin Hood in the forest of Judah, and he brings his court together. And it's interesting how this court is described. Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all of his servants were standing about him. Saul's there sitting underneath this tree. All of his servants are around him. Saul is holding a court with his entourage, and Interestingly enough, Saul's ever-present spear is again in his hand. Saul is now basically almost a raging paranoiac. And we see that revealed as Saul begins to speak in verse 7. Then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, "Hear now, ye Benjaminites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" Saul appeals to the people around him and he calls them all Benjaminites. Now, this is not necessarily an unusual occurrence, for kings, especially paranoid kings, want to have people around them that they can trust. And who can you trust better than your family? And so he has all of these Benjaminites around him. Interestingly enough, if you remember the end of Judges. And all these Benjaminites, all of Saul's family is around him as his servants. And he says, he appeals to their better nature. He appeals to their want for prestige and for property. Is David, although he doesn't name David, remember, if you are on the outs with someone, you don't name them. He is merely the son of Jesse. Is the son of Jesse going to give you vineyards and fields? Is he going to make you captains of thousands and hundreds? The implied answer is no. He continues in verse 8 that all of you have conspired against me. There is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. He accuses everyone there of being a part of the conspiracy. You've all conspired against me. All of my family is plotting my demise. Why? Because none of you told me about this friendship between David and Jonathan. And then he makes this really pitiful statement. I read this, I just couldn't stop smiling. And there is none of you that is sorry for me. There's none of you that's sorry for me. Or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. Now, we thought Saul's problem with this relationship between his son and David was that Jonathan had known that David was going to be the next king, that David was going to rise up against Saul. And now here at the verse 8, he's not that sure that that's the way it's going to happen. He says, "None of you showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day." He says, you know what, the plot is that Jonathan's been stirring up David against me because Jonathan wants to get rid of me so he can be king. This Saul, this great king, has spiraled downward in this death spiral into a vicious paranoia. David wants to be king, Jonathan wants to be king, all of y'all are involved in the plot, all of y'all are conspiring against me, and there's nothing that I can be sure of except the spear in my hand. My spear is for me, and none of you are sorry for me at all. And the comfort for Saul comes from a very unlikely source. Then answered Doeg the Edomite. Wait a second. Who is this guy Doeg? Well, the people of Edom are the sons of Esau. They are relatives of the children of Israel. Doeg is an Edomite. And according to Deuteronomy 23, the children of Israel were not supposed to despise the Edomites. Why? Because they were their brothers. And in Samuel chapter 14, we learn that Saul has fought against the Edomites. It says that, "So Samuel took the kingdom of Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the children of Ammon, and against Edom." And so Saul had basically fought against Edom and determined the boundary. Now, Doeg shows up in chapter 21. When David runs to Ahimelech the priest, Doeg is there. He's mentioned briefly in one verse, verse 7. "Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belongeth to Saul." Now, Doeg, then, is a servant of Saul, may be captured on one of Saul's raids against Edom. But Doeg is a chief servant of Saul. But for one reason or another, it's described he is detained before the Lord. Now, why is he detained there? Well, it could be a number of things, but it seems that Doeg, for one reason or another, was there imprisoned, couldn't leave. And so, obviously, he might have a little bit of an axe to grind against the priests in Nob. Doeg says to Saul, verse 9, "Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I, Saul, the son of Jesse, coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub." Now, this is interesting also because Doeg is there in the midst of all of these Benjaminites. Doeg seems to have a high place among the servants. This foreigner has a significant place in Saul's court. And he's the one that tattles on the priests of Nob. Verse 10, "And he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine." Doeg is this little skulking quizzling. You can just... reminds me of Wormtongue in The Lord of the Rings. It's a little slimy guy who tattles on David and these priests, all probably to get back at them for detaining him before the Lord. Maybe he had unwittingly or wittingly desecrated something at the altar or at the tabernacle, and they were detaining him for a certain period of time. Sin and power have corrupted Saul. This man who once was God's anointed king of Israel is now fallen into this pit of paranoia. Power itself is not proof either of blessing or judgment. We cannot agree with Lord Acton's conclusion that power is an immediate disqualification. All power does is that it allows its wielder a broader canvas on which to order either good or evil. It can be an occasion to sin, but it can be an occasion to do good. Yet Saul definitely, because out of his sin, uses it as an occasion to do evil. It's that power to which Saul has made an idol. It is that power which Saul seeks to cling to absolutely that brings him into this pit of paranoia. Now, every person will stand in a position of power at one point in life. If it is a father over children, a mother over children, a employer over an employee, a manager over a coworker. Every single one of us, a teacher over students, every single one of us will have or be in a position of power. And it will show what we are like. Will we use power for good or for evil? Will we make it an idol, or will we submit to it as one who is under power? In the days when Christianity was held in esteem, those who were in positions of power were called ministers, for they held their position not in their own right, but as ministers under God who were to execute His will upon those beneath them. They were not ruling for themselves. They were ruling consciously or subconsciously in the place of God. They were not to execute what they wanted to do, but what God wanted to do. And that reality is what we must grasp if we would hold on to our integrity and not use our power as the grasping tyrant Saul, but rather as our life-giving Lord. The court leads to a trial, and the notion of a kangaroo court comes quickly to mind. The verdict is assured. even before the victim, the defendant, is called to the stand. And Ahimelech's defense only serves to prove the unreasonableness of our paranoid tyrant. In verse 11, Saul calls the priest. This verse says, "Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, and the priests that were in Nob. And they all came, all of them, to the king." Now, I am fascinated by names sometimes, because in the Bible, names mean things. For instance, Ahitub means, "My father is good," or "My father is wealthy." Ahitub means, "My brother is good," "My brother is wealthy." Ahimelech means, "My brother is king." Now, that opens up a whole range of questions. Now, naturally, the brother of a Levite could not be a Benjaminite, because Saul is from Benjamin and priests are from Levi. But it could mean, "My brother-in-law is the king." And of course, Ahimelech would not name himself that, but his father would. And brother could mean son of my brother, different relational issues, but there is an element, there is at least some indication that that Ahimelech could be in some way related to Saul. So when Saul calls Ahitub and all of the priests of Nob, it's not merely an inquisition of some Levite that he has no connection with. It's a relative, possibly, that Saul is hauling before his court. And all of the priests come obediently to the summons of the king. In verse 12, "And Saul said, 'Hear now, thou son of Ahitub.'" And here we go. Ahimelech is not named again because Saul is angry. "And he," that is Ahimelech, "answered, 'Here I am, my lord.' And Saul said unto him, 'Why have ye conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?'" Saul sees David lying in wait. He's in the forests of Judah, lying in wait for Saul, for any opportunity that he has to capture the capital and kill Saul. Saul accuses Ahimelech of conspiracy to dethrone the king with David. He accuses him of aid to an enemy of the state. He accuses him of providing arms to a traitor. He accuses him of conveying secured intelligence to the enemy in inquiring of God. He accuses Ahimelech of concealing all of this from the king in this conspiracy. Well, Ahimelech responds in verse 14, "And Ahimelech answered the king and said, 'And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David?'" Ahimelech says, "O king, David is your most faithful servant. There's no one in your house as faithful as David. He is the best, brightest, most faithful, honest guy you have. If you wanted a bodyguard you could depend upon, you would make him David. And more than this, he's your son-in-law. You let him marry your daughter. He is your relative." He says, "Which is thy son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in all thine house." He is your most trusted servant. He's your son-in-law. He goes wherever you tell him to go, and does whatever you tell him to do, and is considered the most honorable man in your whole entourage. He's the guy that everyone can depend upon. Verse 15, "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all of this, less or more. Ahimelech says, I had no idea. David comes to me. He is the most honorable man in your house. He's your son-in-law. You send him and tell him to do whatever he wants to do. David said he was sent on a mission from you, and I gave him all the assistance I could, like I would do of any of your servants. I was being absolutely faithful to you, king, because one of your servants came to me in need, and I did my best for him. And I had no idea, I have no idea that he was plotting against you. Verse 16, the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. It was as if Saul had just turned off. No matter what Ahimelech said, his fate was sealed before he ever stepped foot in Saul's court. It didn't matter what Ahimelech said. Saul was going to see him dead because he had helped David. It doesn't matter that David is the most honorable man in his house. It doesn't matter that Ahimelech was doing all of this as unto the king. It doesn't matter anything. Ahimelech could have come and said, David who? I don't know a David. Never saw him before. Who's David? Goliath's sword? Never had it. Didn't matter. Saul was unreasoning, totally paranoid about what was going on. And the enemies of God are equally as unreasonable. The enemies of God are equally as unconvincible. Their hearts, God says, are like stone. You know how easy it is to penetrate stone? Try it sometime. It doesn't work too well. You could talk to them, reason with them till you're blue in the face, and it will not work. The enemies of God are determined upon destruction of God's people. End of story. That's it. And that is why the disciples once asked Jesus, how then is anyone saved? Jesus said, with man it is impossible, but with God all things are impossible. And that's why Ezekiel, when he talks about us having hearts of stone, God says, I took out their heart of stone and put into them a heart of flesh, because that's the only way someone comes to God. But we can't mistake this vital fact. We can't think that it lies within us to convince people that somehow by our wise and sage reasoning abilities that we can dissuade people from desiring the destruction of God's people. For they are like Saul, consumed with wrath, determined upon the destruction of all that is good. The verdict of death was presumed from the beginning, but the verdict is executed in an unusual way. The sad reality is that it is the king of Israel, the king of God's people, that orders the destruction of God's servants. But who will execute such a command? We turn now to verse 17. The king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. 85 guys standing there, but all of Saul's servants are there in attendance. Remember, he's there under the tree, spear in hand. And all of Saul's servants, but the servants of the king, would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. All the servants of Saul, new. I am not going to get God mad at me by killing his servants. That's worse than 7 years bad luck from breaking a mirror. No. Not going to do that. Saul's servants restrain their hand. They won't do it. So Saul turns, verse 18, the king said to Doeg, "Turn thou and fall upon the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell on the priests, and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. Servants of Saul say, mm-mm. Saul turns to someone who had no axe to bear. Doeg was an Edomite. He wasn't even admitted to the tabernacle. He was a Gentile. He was not of Israel. He had no truck with this God of Israel, and he had no qualms at all about killing the priests who had detained him, who had probably imprisoned him. And he turned and slew 85 priests that day. Now, Ahimelech brings all the priests up to Saul. They're there in Gibeah. Saul's there with the spear. All of his servants are there who refuse to kill the priests. And Doeg kills 85 people in front of Saul and all of his servants. Oh, servants, oh no, they're not going to kill the priests, but they'll just sit there and watch while Doeg goes through them like a weed eater. Doeg then, not satisfied with 85 deaths, decides he's going to go to Nob, the city of the priests, and basically puts the city under the ban. And verse 19, "And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, oxen, asses, and sheep with the edge of the sword." Question. How many swords are there in Israel? Earlier in the book of Samuel, we learned that there are only two. Well, now there are three. Jonathan had one, Saul had one, and David got Goliath's. Jonathan gave his to David. David probably left it when he got the Philistine sword in Nob. Who is Doeg killing all these people with? He's killing him, like as not, with Saul's sword. He goes through Nob, the city of the priests, and kills everybody. This tremendous slaughter of the servants of God is executed with the king's own sword. But there's one that escapes. Verse 20, "And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after Saul, after David. And Abiathar showed Saul, David, that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it, that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul." David had been there at the tabernacle and looked over and saw Doeg detained, and said, "That guy, that's not good. He's going to tell Saul I'm here." And David says in verse 22, "I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house." David says to Abiathar, "Yeah, Saul did it, but it's my fault. It's my responsibility. I had this bad feeling when I saw Doeg there, and now it has been the occasion for the destruction of that line of priests." Verse 23, David says, "Abide thou with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life, but with me thou shalt be in safeguard." David says, "Hey, stay here. Stay here, because the guy who wants to kill me wants to kill you wants to kill me. We're in this together. But with me, you'll be safe." As always, David points us forward to a reality beyond David. David points us forward to our Lord. Because the forces of evil are always going to be against God's people. The world, the flesh, and the devil have one goal in mind, and that is the destruction of God's people. And there's only one place of safety. There's only one place of refuge. There's only in one person that you can be safe, and that is in our Lord Jesus. For Satan seeks to destroy. Jesus said, the thief seeks to kill, to maim, and destroy. I have come to bring you life and to bring it more abundantly. Satan seeks to destroy your life. Sin and death conspire to consume your soul. Jesus is not a crutch. Jesus is not an opiate that prevents us from dealing with the grim realities of life. He is not some kind of comfy security blanket we carry as a talisman to psychologically bring us through events in life which do not turn out the way we plan. He's not merely a better bet than rank nihilism. Instead, Jesus is the only safety you have in a world that seeks to do you harm. Jesus is the only security there is in a life of misery and death. Jesus is the one who can provide safety, because all of the forces that want to destroy, to kill, and make you miserable aren't really after you, but they're after Him. And if you would find safety, if you would find life, if you would find security, you must look to Christ. Believer, Jesus is on the side of His people. There's nothing in life that you have to fear. Those words of David in that last verse speak volumes as you hear them through the throat of Christ. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit except it abide in the vine, so you cannot bear fruit except you abide in me. And David says, abide thou with me, do not fear, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life. Jesus says, abide with me. For everything that's against you is ultimately against me, and guess what? I'm God, and it cannot overcome me. The gates of hell will not prevail against Christ's church. We are secure in Christ because we abide in Him, and our enemies are His enemies. When the Catechism talks about benefits do we get from Christ's office as a king, it says that He conquers His and our enemies. And it's not His and ours as if they're two different things. He has His enemies, we have our enemies, and He takes care of both of them. But His enemies are our enemies. Our enemies are His enemies, because we are on the same side. And it is right for us to submit ourselves to Him. When life comes at you and you don't know where to turn for safety, when you have something in your life that you fear, do you look to yourself or do you look to God? Do you look to Christ? Do you seek to manage the situation on your own, or do you look to the hands of your Savior, who will fight your battles and deliver you out of all your troubles? It may not be tomorrow, it may not be immediately. For the Bible tells us that in this world we will have tribulation. But God is the God who delivers, and He will deliver you.